May I proceed?
You may. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
4 minutes, please. Thank you. Mike Hunsinger, representing appellant Nick Riney, who's president of the courtroom. We all agree on what the applicable law here is. With a committed intimate relationship, only quasi-community property can be distributed. All separate property goes back to the parties who brought separate property into the CIR, and not just those assets that were brought in, but also rents, income, dividends, profit, and appreciation of value during the CIR.
So you don't dispute that there was a committed intimate relationship?
I did not file an appeal based upon that grant.
So your dispute has to do with the date that it began?
No, we're using October 31st, or second week in November 1995, as the date the CIR established. I'm using that for the purpose of this argument. We're not going to...
But what was the trial court's finding on that?
The trial court found in the decree and judgment that the CIR began when the parties moved into the house that Mr. Bruny bought on the second week of November.
And so that's why you're using a November date, because that's the date the deed was signed?
That's correct, November 16th, 1995. And that's why Mr. Bruny presented in the trial his net worth as of October 31st, 1995. Each month, Mr. Bruny prepared a net worth statement, and that's the net worth that the court used to establish his separate property also, leading into the CIR, which consisted of two categories of assets. First, his one-half interest in his business worth $708,000. The second, a combination of liquid assets worth approximately $500,000. Both of which are currently separate property. But there was also a third asset that was separate property as of the time the CIR began, which was the house Mr. Bruny bought simultaneously with the start of the CIR. It's undisputed that that was money, his separate property that was used for the down payment, $74,000 of the $360,000 purchase price, his separate money, his name on title, and his credit for the remaining $296,000. So we have the three assets we're fighting over are the three assets that were all Mr. Bruny's separate property as of the middle of November 1995. We also are all in agreement, and the judge made this very clear throughout the trial, that the burden then fell upon Ms. Morgan to prove by direct and positive evidence of any aspect of any of those three separate assets was the result of community, quasi-community, contributions.
Well, but
or
didn't
services.
The court conclude that the house was a quasi-community asset? So then the burden wouldn't be on her at that point. Wouldn't it be on Mr. Bruny to show that it was separate?
No, Judge Strickey. In fact, the court ruled that it was clearly community property, right. Period. But that is patently reversible error, because there's all the evidence, the undisputed evidence, is that it was Mr. Bruny's separate property that was used to pay the down payment, to pay the that was in his name, etc.
Let me phrase it differently then. Fine. So one construction of the court's ruling was that the court concluded that Ms. Morgan had met her burden and had shown that the house was a quasi-community. So your argument is that there's insufficient evidence of that? Is that what you're saying?
That there's no evidence of that. And the court just said it. And the court, underlying the word prior is separate, and she seemed to sort of be implying that, well, simultaneously with, and therefore it's community or quasi-community, and frankly, it doesn't matter. The court could have been correct in saying it was community property. That presumption is rebutted by Mr. Bruny's proof that his own separate $74,000 was used to buy the house. So it doesn't matter whether it was community or separate. Mr. Bruny established he met his burden by clear and direct evidence of overcoming the presumption that it was community property if that conclusion of law was correct, which it wasn't. In either case, as of the date that deal closed, that was Mr. Bruny's separate property.
So in the end, the issue is, from the appellant's perspective, whether or not Mr. Bruny showed by clear and convincing evidence that it was not a quasi-community asset.
Well,
see, because we have to look at the burden of
proof. I know, and you can't, but the thing is, you can't tell from the court's findings what the basis was for her finding that it was clearly community property. You can't tell. She doesn't say. She does not say a word about that.
In terms of the other evidence that was admitted, is it your position that the court cannot consider the testimony such as they were looking for the house together, they wanted to cohabit together, she was in charge of the remodel, all that evidence? You're saying none of that is relevant?
Or correct.
That's insufficient?
No, it's not relevant because it was Ms. Morgan's burden of proving that not only did she do those things, but that they, established direct and positive evidence, that they increased the value of the house. And under Elam, also the amount that those services increased the value of the house.
The clock is ticking, so we've asked you a lot of questions. But turning to the issue of the other assets, what is your argument in that encapsulation?
The first asset, that one half interest in the business, the judge properly took care of that.
Yeah, the judge ruled that's
separate property. And the reason was because Ms. Morgan, the respondent, provided inadequate evidence that there was any community contribution, services, whatever, that contributed to the $600,000 increase in the value of that house.
Well, what about the retirement?
The investment accounts, the court provided no findings of fact. Zero. None. Not one. Her only statements were that Ms. Morgan needed support.
All right. Thank you. You have your 4 minutes.
I'll take one more minute here to answer Judge Trickey's question, if I could, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to the house, the court cited three reasons why there may be some, for the reasons that the house increased in value. One of which was that Ms. Morgan's services contributed to the value. Not one word of that. Not one word establishing 1 cent that it contributed to the value. Number two was what Mr. Briney contributed during the community. Not one word about that. Number three was market appreciation of the house, which is true by Ms. Morgan's own evidence. That house, by her appraiser, testimony was the house became worth $1.09 million, of which $800,000 was the land. Nothing more. So if there was no house on that property, that house, which was purchased for $360,000 by Mr. Briney, went up to $800,000 through no assistance or cooperation or services or money of either party. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Zeeshan Khan. I'm here on behalf of Ms. Morgan. I'm going to apologize in advance. I suspect the same flu that Mr. Huntinger does. If I don't speak loudly, please feel free to yell at me and ask me to speak louder. Your Honors have clearly read this case, and you understand the details behind it. This is not a short-term relationship. This is a committed, intimate relationship that spanned roughly 27 years. The court's findings are fundamentally about a just and equitable division of community-like assets. Now, that's part one. That simply deals with those assets that would ordinarily be presumed to be community-like. The house fell under that category.
So, the only real asset that the trial court found was a quasi-community asset was the house.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the Borgi case from 2009 seems to say, just because it's on the deed, that's not enough. Now, here she wasn't on the deed, but if I'm understanding appellant's argument correctly, we look only at the funds that were used to pay the house and in conjunction with whose name is on the deed, and that's him. So under Borgi, how does the court's conclusion that it's a quasi-community asset stand up? This is my question.
Well, the trick is also that the funds that were originally used were just solely separate funds, and there's no evidence to suggest that's the case. The parties had actually been together in relationships in 1987, many years before this. So if we assume that there's any point in time before that, that there is a community that effectively exists, then the parties are going to have a community, like income that is derived during that time. It's going to be at least community. The burden then falls on Mr. Briney to show with clear and cogent evidence, that clear and convincing evidence, my apologies, that those funds that went were solely separate, that went into the down.
What evidence was there that there was commingling of funds before 1995? What evidence?
Well, Your Honor, let me answer that in two parts. One, there are statements that go back to, and I couldn't exactly remember at this point, I'm sorry, that show that there's a sort of fluid interchange of funds that the parties have been living together. That admittedly, Mr. Barney had been paying for a lot of the expenses together. But more importantly, the burden isn't necessarily on Ms. Morgan to show that that commingling exists if the burden is initially on Mr. Briney to effectively upset the presumption of community, if that makes sense.
Are you saying that Mr. Briney failed to prove by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that the down payment was his sole funds and not some source of commingled or quasi-community fund?
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think that burden falls upon him to basically make that determination. But the second part of it, I think, is that it doesn't necessarily matter whether these are completely separate funds, because as this court and the Supreme Court have noted in multiple cases, even those separate assets can be divisible as effectively an equitable lien based on the contributions.
But not in a CIR case.
In fact, in a CIR case, Your Honor.
What are you relying on for that?
Both the Lindemann case and the Soltero case both have that. Lindemann was a case in which we had a separate asset. It was an auto shop. The husband, de facto husband in this case, had an auto shop. He wasn't doing very well. Apparently, he had some substance abuse problems. He then was in a CIR with his soon-to-be wife, and the court was effectively addressing whether that period of time in which they were in a CIR was divisible and whether that wife would effectively have an equitable interest in that auto shop, which incidentally thrived because of her tutelage and care under his
The facts in Lindemann, the one partner came to the relationship having had a severe drug problem. The business wasn't really even, if it was in existence, it was barely in existence.
Yep.
He maintains, he recovers sobriety, and there's sort of joint efforts towards the business. That isn't really what we have here to the house, is it?
Well, in a way, it is, Your Honor. A key point to actually distinguish, and I think bolster our position, is that in Lindemann, the wife in that case never even stepped foot. I mean, never actively did work on behalf of the auto shop. It was effectively a de facto, you bolstered the husband who was then able to then take care of the business and it thrived under his care. In this case, they have direct... I'm sorry.
Didn't Lindemann conclude that it was the appreciation and the value of the business that the wife had an equitable claim to, not that the business itself remained his separate property?
That's right, Your Honor.
So following along from that, with regard to the retirement accounts or the investment accounts, do you agree with appellant's counsel that there really are no findings of fact on those accounts?
I do not, Your Honor. There are actually...
Where can you direct our attention to a finding on that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There are actually three, and I'll focus on two. There are three issues and moments at which Mr. Briney effectively concedes one way or another that these are funds that had at least some component of community contribution or effort. One of them is in his summary judgment declaration, in which he says effectively these funds increased in value, certainly in part because of their natural...
And that was one of the admitted declarations?
It was, Your Honor, yes. And that the funds also increased because of the work and labor that I put into them. A second thing that I would say supports that is what we would label, I think, Trial Court Exhibit 78, which is now before the court, which effectively showed financial accounts that have a fluid interchange between those funds that are going into investment accounts with those funds that are being used for de facto community purposes. The party's living expenses, the party's going out, all those kinds of things. And, in fact, that is how the parties lived.
So let me ask you about the exhibits. They were actually marked by Mr. Briney, right? He wanted them in, but they were never admitted at trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then there was a post-trial hearing, and the judge signed an order saying that they can become part of the record. But, I mean, even unadmitted exhibits or objected exhibits can become part of the record. Does that order say that they that the trial court considered them? Because they're not in the recital of the exhibits and the findings that the trial court considered.
Yes, Your Honor. So to go back a little bit, the way that those exhibits specifically worked is that Mr. Briney sought to introduce them. We raised an initial objection. What the judge ordered was, well, rather than make a decision now, I'm going to reserve my ruling and wait for this to actually come about. There was a hearing that no one actually did anything further on it. So as far as the final ruling went, it was just a reserved ruling. And, of course, as we noted and briefed in our motion to allow those exhibits, that there's case law supporting that that should have been allowed, that the reservation is effectively allowing it in until the objection is sustained. Now, I think going back to the second...
That may be, but isn't it clear that the court did not then consider those exhibits?
No, Your Honor, and thank you for bringing me to that second point, which is that the court actually made specific reference to an exhibit without actually naming that exhibit, which is the court effectively says there was one exhibit in which effectively there is an interplay between Mr. Briney's finances. Now, the court did not...
And is that, where is the court referencing that?
Let me find that for you, Your Honor.
And is that a reference to one of the exhibits that the court reserved ruling on?
It is, Your Honor. And in fact, that was a basis for the motion for reconsideration. Mr. Briney had argued that there was no such evidence in play. We argued that there was. And I can find that if Your Honor would like me to look that.
It's totally up to you how you want to use your
time. Okay. But as I'm looking, if Your Honors have, you know, sort of follow-up questions on this, obviously, you know, the second point that I'm sort of focusing on is that there is ample evidence to support that Ms. Morgan would have an equitable lien on so many of these. There's a factual detail in this case that I think can't be understated, which is effectively that Mr. Briney went through a bout of depression so severe that his former business partner and best friend was on the stand testifying to the fact that he was like a hollow human being, like a zombie, that he had not just sort of suicidal ideations, but very likely suicidal threats, and Ms. Morgan had actually taken his handgun and put it away for his own safety.
To jump back out,
of course.
Disrupt your flow, I apologize, back to the down payment, finding 11 says, the parties agree, Mr. Briney paid the initial down payment of $74,000, see exhibits 73 and 74. Why isn't that a finding that it was his separate funds that were used to pay the down payment?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there are sufficient findings to show that that's the case. I think that those findings just simply say that, say, a check was written by Mr. Briney. But not that those funds were solely his separate funds if there was, in fact, a presumption of community from the beginning at that point. If that answers your question, Your Honor.
I guess the only other thing is what exhibit the court was referring to that was not admitted.
Well, ultimately, the exhibit that we're referring to is Exhibit 78 as the trial record, Your Honor, but it was ultimately admitted, and based on a motion to allow that to be included as part of the record, the court did allow that to be included and, of course, forwarded.
But you were referencing in the record where the court discussed one of these exhibits that you say bolsters your position.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me see if I can find it. I recognize that I'm now out of time, so I may not have the opportunity, but... if the court will give me a moment, I'm happy to look it up.
Well, we'll hear
reply
from appellant's counsel, and then you can just tell us if you know
Absolutely.
What number it is or what reference to the RP.
Okay. It's CP 685, conclusion of law 5.
Could you hold on just one
moment? I'm
sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
And this is, it's the court's conclusion of law 5, page 17 of the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, court's paper 685. Can I explain the context?
Please.
First of all, what happened was I included this exhibit only in the joint statement of evidence, objected to by Mr. Kahn. Three questions of it asked by me of Mr. Briney in trial. No cross-examination by Mr. Kahn, no offer in evidence by me. That's it. Not considered by the court in her findings. She specifically outlined which exhibit she considered, and one of them was not Exhibit 78. Four hearings, 13 months later, Mr. Kahn finally decides, I want to have that exhibit in, without no opportunity for us to provide any evidence of even what was said in that, let alone an opportunity to rebut it. And in the context of the finding, the trial judge refers to that exhibit in the context of this ain't enough to establish direct and positive evidence.
And I'm sorry, which finding is that again?
Five. It's conclusion of law 5.
Conclusion of law 5.
And it carries, on page, it carries over to page 17 of the findings, and that's the half of that conclusion that discusses that. And that is an obtuse reference to Exhibit 78. And Judge Schindler, no, the judge did not order that this would be considered part of the record for this appeal. Right? Specifically did not do that. nor should it be considered, because we never had the opportunity to introduce any evidence as to what it actually meant. Couple of quickies. Judge Brennan, correct about the finding that regarding the down payment of the house, not only did the court find that it was Mr. Briney's separate money, and the court found that Mr. Briney had $500,000 in the bank 16 days before closing, but the court also found, and this is finding 9, that at that time, Ms. Morgan had a used Honda and no savings. That is way more than direct and positive evidence. That takes care of the house as separate property. On the investment accounts and the quote evidence, the information given to you by opposing counsel as a support of that, you will not find any of that in the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Do you agree with his argument that if we found that the trial court properly allowed those exhibits post-trial, that there's evidence in those exhibits to support that position?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not whatsoever. And I make a sort of a vague reference to it because I didn't want to get into an exhibit that wasn't part of the record. Absolutely not. It's a check register for 1 year, 2006, out of 34 tax returns and 208 monthly statements for invest accounts. Only six statements of which Ms. Morgan introduced, none of which contained any information about increase in value. 34 tax returns. The only income that showed was Mr. Briney lost $47,000 in that year.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That concludes argument in this case, unless you had some citation.
No, Your Honor. I think Mr. Hunter would have provided to sort that.
All right. Thank you very much to both counsel. And Mr. Grannis, if you can remain, we do have a message.